I am a public prosecutor by training, and I currently work at Eurojust as the deputy for the national member for Austria. There are two more Austrians in here. If I use case examples, which might refer to other countries and put them in not a very favorable light, I will just put Austria instead. So I hope my colleagues do not mind. Austrians have a tendency to depreciate themselves a little bit. The last few hundred years of history has taught us that we are not as grand as we thought, or as we used to be anyway. Maybe last preliminary remark. Our previous speakers already covered a little bit of what I think is quite important, and so I'm glad that at some points I will be able to refer actually to what they said earlier. And I might be able to skip like some of the points a little bit, so we'll just be able to move on a little bit faster. Judicial challenges, especially from the point of view of Eurojust, many, many issues have already been covered. So that's more or less the outline I'm going to follow. You've heard already how important money is, no dough, no show. Clearly, from my point of view, in terrorism cases, if someone's a suicide bomber, he doesn't really want to make much money out of the act. But at some point, he still may need the money to actually get the bomb working, or he might need the money to actually go to the place where he's going to do actually commit the act. So even though it's not purely a financial motivated crime, still, without money, it might be much harder to actually commit it. But just to keep in mind that in some crime areas, money is really the driving force, whereas in terrorism cases, I think I see a very big part also in political motivated things, and money is just a means to achieve the end. Having said that, of course, if we look at IS, who actually base his soldiers, without money, there is a rabbit not working of the structure anymore. And if we look at oil fields that were under the control of IS, of course, there is a lot of money involved. And of course, there are players involved. And if we manage to be able to disrupt that system, we have managed a big step ahead. So some of the few challenges were already mentioned. The geographical areas, once we leave Europe, everything is a little bit more difficult. Once we leave the European Union, the troubles start, but even within we have some challenges, as already mentioned before. The guy with the question mark, sometimes we just do not know, well, we have the money, but we don't know who it belongs to or how it is really is connected. Already mentioned as well. Once money is on the move, it's really tricky to catch it. So we see the guy like catching not the butterfly, but the banknote. It can be tricky even within the state, but once the money leaves the state, we are on a race against time. Virtual currencies were mentioned before. Sherah said it's not such a big issue. I'm just not sure. I think it might be useful for terrorists. I think it's more difficult for us to deal with it, whether it's 1% or 10% or whether it's an increasing amount of percent, I cannot say, but it's definitely something that makes our work more difficult. As well as cash operations, of course. Sherah mentioned the 500 euro banknote. I think the 1,000 francs, Swiss francs banknote is the easiest means to carry a lot of value around. It's supposedly more efficient, supposedly. At current gold prices, it's definitely easier to carry a lot of money around in francs than in gold, for example. And then, of course, we need to get hold of the money and freeze it in time. A different aspect, the connections, and then just the wide space we have to cover. And another black guy with a white question mark, And this time it's the unknown players. Unknown players, like I mentioned the oil fields. Who buys oil in such quantities and who helps them, or who buys artifacts in such quantities? And how is it possible that such a big operation is not seen by the neighbor states? So there is a lot of unknown stuff going on. And whoever is there in the gray zone might not have any interest at all in supporting our law enforcement operation, in actually helping us discover who's the bad guys and where are the assets. Because whatever back trail there is might eventually end up there. So if someone is in a position to support or disrupt our law enforcement actions, and that someone is also part of the structure, then we run against dead walls, and that might happen very quickly if we get into the wrong countries. So once the money or the assets leave certain areas, it's really tricky. So if I may refer to Austria, which is, as you all may be aware of, an island, for example, and some of the Austrian laws are especially designed to safeguard bank secrecy, do not exchange tax information, do not keep any records, maybe to make it especially easy to set up a letterbox company or similar things. It's pretty difficult to follow that money once it enters Austria. And yeah. So this is us. You see the big ship of Eurojust at the top right center. It's actually not the whole building, belongs to us, just a little bit of it. And we will moving closer to Europol, hopefully quite soon. And I hope it's not just a symbolic move, but also a move that allows us to closer cooperate, because I followed your presentation with very much interest. And I think we can learn a lot from Europol, and I think a closer cooperation between Europol and Eurojust can profit, of course, to all of you. Basically, we are the European Judicial Agency. We are there to support prosecutors and judges who need us. We have members of the 28 member states, and we have liaison prosecutors from Norway, Switzerland, and USA. And furthermore, we also have contact points a little bit spread around all over the world. It's around 40. So it's quite nice to bring us on board. We also have a database. It's not a big, big database as I think Europol has, but it's still a database which contains entities and entities that are cross-linked. Basically, we introduce 8 entities into our system. It's case management systems, that's what the abbreviation CMS stands for. And for the cases of asset detection, I think the most relevant are bank information, maybe car information, and maybe phone numbers and stuff, to detect cross links between corresponding cases. In terms of asset recovery, I think if we get a hit on CMS, it's way too late. I think there should have been a hit much earlier at Europol, which has more or less, I think, the same data at an earlier time. And I think that's quite a passive system. And it only helps if 2 cases have the same entities. So if we have bank information of a bank account in Austria, and there is no corresponding bank account, there is no hit, and then we will not find a cross-link. So that's quite an important issue to keep in mind. So this tool CMS is like a backbone, and it can be helpful, but I think in asset recovery, it's probably not very, very helpful. It's just so you have it in mind, there is CMS, and it's supposed to be quite useful to find parallel cases, to find links, but it all depends, of course, on the amount of data we actually have and of information that has been entered before. So much more important than the passive CMS system, I think, is the exchange of information in a much more active way. And I'm happy that Wenke, for example, already mentioned the spontaneous exchange of information. This picture is not just about spontaneous exchange of information. This picture is also about information services, secret services, who have a long tradition of gathering information and of keeping information and of sharing information on a case-by-case basis based on interests more than legal obligation. We, from the judiciary side, we share because we have to share, and we share because we see that it's legally the right thing to do, not because we think it could help us in the short or long run. So, I know from an Austrian case that even within a country, there might be an issue with information sharing. That even within a country, information services might have a tendency to keeping the information, be it in order to protect someone, or be it just because they do not deem it very useful to share that information at that moment. So that's a tricky aspect, and I think we are on a good way towards more proactive and more extensive information sharing. So from the judiciary point of view, we definitely are, but I think also the information services are in the right way, and within the European Union are several initiations to actually do that, initiatives. So we are hoping for a better way to exchange information. If someone doesn't know how to do that, you just can assist. Actually, we are quite a good facilitator of information sharing. And that's something I will go into more depth now. Eurojust consists of a college of 28 people. We all speak one language. I mean, we have a few native speakers as of now, but still our English is kind of okay, and normally we manage to make ourselves understood. So one common language which we use to communicate with each other, and one common language which we use to communicate with our people. So when an Austrian guy needs something, he either writes me an email or he gives me a phone call. And he will quickly realize, and it's funny because just last month someone from Austria called me and didn't know that I was actually Austrian and started speaking in English with me, which was quite amusing, but it's nice to know there is someone who speaks your own language. But once you leave the border, it's more tricky. That's why we are here for. We can achieve to actually bring people together, to let them speak in their own language, and still be understood by someone else. That's what we understand when we talk about a coordination meeting. That's when people come together. And if you imagine that every one of you in here is part of a coordination meeting, think of yourselves as groups of three. Then you might be a public prosecutor, and you might be a policeman, and you would be maybe the national member of Austria, and so on, with all of you. We sit around in the big oval center, you all have the headphones, and you are actually allowed to speak in your own language. And it will be translated into your own language. So you'll be able to talk about your case, to get to know about other cases, to share that information, to bundle information, to see links, and to talk about what you intend to do and what hear what others intend to do. And eventually you might be able to negotiate what's the best way forward for all of you in terms of prosecution of a crime. So that's the coordination meeting. It's in a way the first step towards a closer cooperation. That first step may lead to a joint investigation team, which was also mentioned earlier. Joint investigation team is a little bit of work to set it up, but once you manage to do that, it's a lot easier to work together because you do not have to write a lot of MLA requests. you just, in theory, and normally it works, you inform your partners what you found out, and your partner, who is probably Austrian, he will take that information and make something useful in his own proceedings. And eventually he will share his outcome with everyone. So instead of being like one little piece of a mosaic with a chit, we should be able to actually get the whole picture. And then, and I'm quite happy that Elie Renard is next to me, we have a coordination center, which should help to focus on action days. On action days, we set up, like, it's not a mobile office, because normally it is at Eurotest, but it is an office where all of us sit together who are involved in an action day. So when the action takes place in the member states, they can inform us right back, we can talk about it and inform each other and let the information flow down again to our member states. And Elie Renard, who is sitting next to me, is here in the front and shows very actively how it would actually look. Highly focused, that's the way it's supposed to be in a coordination center. So these three main tools are what we can offer. You might have realized that I didn't mention asset recovery as such in all these special tools. I will come back to that. This is how normally everything works. The national authority contacts the national desk. Who contacts again the other desks? Mostly it is in English. Only when Austria deals with Germany or Switzerland, we stay in our own language or in our own related languages. Then the respective desks contact their national authorities. They give a feedback and the feedback, and eventually everything, the information flow, gets back to the national authority who first requested. And then the whole thing may start again and again and again. In that way, if you look at it like at the diagram, it's not very efficient as such, because of course the direct contact might be quicker, but if you count all the language issues, which we have to deal with most of the time, but it can be even tricky without language issues, then it's quite efficient. And we manage to actually forward information always within 24 hours. Sometimes it's even quicker. So we are really, really fast. So, even though Eurotest was to a very huge degree also founded because in order to assist mainly in cases of serious border crime like terrorism, we were lucky enough not to have so many terrorism cases in the past. Lucky enough because the terrorist situation has much evolved in the last few years. And you see here with a back leg as well, eventually the terrorism cases arrived as well in Eurotest. So probably for 2017 it might be even higher, because it's a learning curve, not just for us, but also for our member states, to see it actually works if they inform us and if they involve us. And they see, oh, we get in touch with colleagues from every other country, so many Austrians meet each other at Eurotest. We can share information and we will have a result. And we trust our partners enough to actually move on with that. And the trust issue was mentioned earlier before. Mr. Saul is not here anymore, but I think that is really a big issue. I think also it's not so much an issue at the level of the judiciary as such. I think the real issue is at the legislative level, maybe. Because if Austria introduces clauses that force member states to argue more and more and more why they would actually want to request that measurement instead of trusting each other, then the judge will be forced to actually obey the law, of course. So the real issue from my point of view is not so much at the judiciary level, but a little bit higher. The the reason why I did not mention asset recovery when I introduced the three great tools we have to offer is because they do not just apply to asset recovery. It is what we do and what we do best, but in all crime areas. And that's where Eurojust has been collecting experience and lessons learned for more than 10 years now. And whatever we learned in general areas of law, we can also apply to asset recovery. We don't have special tools for asset recovery. We don't have a magic wand to freeze money or to find money or to confiscate money. We are just mainly here to facilitate communication. And that's what we do, and that's what we do best. We do it quick, we do it reliable, we do it per email. I think most member states should have like a secure line of communication with Eurojust, so we can trust our data when we transmit it by email. But it's a very general tool, and we apply it to whatever crime area there is, and be it asset recovery or be it trafficking in human beings, be it terrorism or organized crime or whatever. Big fish and small fish. Well, we heard of course that small amounts of money make important amounts of money when they actually arrive where they are supposed to arrive, or at least once they arrive higher up in the hierarchy and towards the collective nodes. Still, I think what we do is always like fishing for the small fish, and even if we fish for a lot of small fish, it's never the big net. So I think a more efficient tool towards that is indeed the sanctions list that's supposed to freeze the money wherever it is, as long as it belongs to someone who actually managed to get himself up on the list. So I think that system is much more efficient. Once the money leaves a certain area, for us it's a race against time. And once the money leaves enough borders or crosses enough borders, we will most likely lose that race. So what would be really good, and now I'm very far away from what we can do as Eurojust, I'm more like in dreamland of prosecution. What would be really good is if we could trace money and stop the money while it is on the move within the European Union, for example. It would be good if we could say money is not supposed to leave the European Union like on the same day the transfer is ordered, but maybe with a 2 days delay. That could give us a lot of precious time to actually catch the money while it's in sort of it's like a layer around Europe, a slow moving zone. No, never going to work, but it's a pity. But it would be also very nice if you could encode all the money that's going to be transferred electronically with some sort of DNA code. So we actually are able to trace it back and we can say, you know, money that stems from that initial transaction is suspicious. Please freeze it and we'll check the suspicion. So dreamland and a lot of issues to be discussed. But we will probably stay within the small catching, the small amounts of money. Still better than nothing, of course. Now I come to two case examples that are, well, as well related to terrorism. Because the Anders Breivik case, which didn't happen in Austria but in Norway, was also a terrorism case, but not so much like most of the terrorism cases we face at the moment, but a very different one. Still, even there, it was important to receive bank information, to get information about foreign bank accounts. So concerning accounts in Antigua and Barbuda, the UK national member assisted, and concerning Latvia, the Latvian national member assisted. So even in cases where it doesn't seem to be too obvious, it can be very important to quickly access banking information and then to see whether there is money there to be frozen or not. And now that's a different case, and that was not a terrorist case. But as I said, it doesn't really matter too much to us what kind of crime area we are actually dealing with. It's more the general framework views for whatever there is. So there it happened on a Thursday evening that a phone call actually entered or arrived at the Austrian office, and an urgent freezing order and a letter of request was announced. That was transmitted a little bit later, and the necessary steps could be taken by the public prosecutor of the target land. And eventually on Friday, the bank says, well, we froze the money, but we actually already have the order to transfer the money onward. So in this case, it wasn't such a small fish, it was 26 million euro, which were frozen at that bank. But if that prosecutor does not call us, the money is gone. And once it is gone from the first bank, probably it doesn't make much sense to further try to follow the money. Because at the end of the day, if you assume that the people are even slightly intelligent, they will try to make it disappear quickly enough.